Alan Kohler here, and I'm talking to Victor Schwetz, who is Macquarie Research's man strategist in Hong Kong, and he's just written a book called The Great Rupture, Do We Need to Be Free? Three Empires, Four Turning Points, and the Future of Humanity. It is a fantastic book, and this is a wonderful interview. It's long, 50 minutes worth. So settle in, make yourself comfortable, and check it out, because Victor is a very smart guy, and he's drawing it all together, all of the things going on here. It's not a very happy story, I have to tell you, but it's so interesting and so important. Brings in modern monetary theory, coronavirus, the information age, and putting all those things into a historical context. So here is Victor Schwetz from Macquarie in Hong Kong and the author of The Great Rupture. Victor, you called your book The Great Rupture. Why that? What's rupturing?
Everything. What we basically described is that industrial revolution really changed the world. And all it has done is just supplemented human muscle power. It didn't really do anything else. Information age, or call it the third industrial revolution, some call it the fourth industrial revolution, is changing everything. It's changing societies, it's changing politics, it's changing how we communicate. It also changes the value of labor inputs. It changes what type of capital is preferred and the value of capital. We essentially, and maybe somewhat unkindly, describe the new age as the age of declining return on humans and declining return on conventional capital. So this time around, we are changing, and we are restructuring, and we are altering pretty much every facet of our life. McKinsey Global Institute argued several years ago that the pace of change today is about 10 times faster than it was in the 19th and 20th century. And the waterfront of changes is about 300 times. So if you combine the two, that means it's about 3,000 times the impact. And the next two decades, even the next 10 years, will be sort of the pinnacle of that transition disruptive time.
So to be clear, you're saying that this revolution, this time we're going through, is much more significant than the Industrial Revolution?
Far more significant. Far deeper, far wider, and also much faster. If you think of the first two Industrial Revolution, transition took several centuries to come through. In our case, information age really started in the early 1970s. The impact significantly accelerated in the last two decades. And the next two decades will be totally different. In a sense, we're saying if somebody woke up in 2040s or 50s, he will not recognize year 2000. He will not recognize even year 2010. Jobs, what is meant to be a human, what is meant to, why is it important that we turn up and work? Why is society structured around jobs? Why do we get educated? We suggested in the book that by 2040s, 50s, maybe the campus of the Harvard College will be closed for lack of demand. Jobs will no longer be the central axis around which our life evolves. As I said, most of the things that we're taking for granted, whether it's political system, social system, interactions, work, human capital, education, skilling, everything is going to change beyond recognition. And again, as most people correctly highlight, we tend to overestimate the degree of change that is likely to happen in the first decade after revolution starts. And we tend to underestimate in the next couple of decades. And then subsequently we realize that we were right after all, and the changes will be dramatic. So to my mind, we have been underestimating for the last couple of decades how much societies are being disrupted. And in the next two decades, we sort of will wake up and understand that there are profound changes that are occurring.
So you have a subtitle Do we need to be free? And when I first saw that, I thought that it might have been a reference to the implications of China's economic success. Is it? It seems to me it's more than that. Looking at the book, it's much broader reference than simply to China, isn't it?
It is much broader than just reference to China. But what we're also arguing that the last, the last five centuries sort of yielded an unequivocal answer that in order to be prosperous, innovative, inventive, or even happy, people needed to be free. And so the first part of the book explains why most Western, non-Western civilization have collapsed, whether it's China, whether it's Russia, whether it's Ottomans. And the reason they've collapsed, they didn't have that freedom that the Western societies increasingly enjoyed over this sort of five centuries. And what we're saying is that the recipe for success might be changing. And countries like China are trying to prove that you no longer need to be free in order to be prosperous, innovative, and perhaps even happy. And what it is, it's really the combination of technology and financialization, what we describe as the Fujiwara effect. In other words, when two hurricanes merge and reinforce each other, that those two hurricanes are changing our environment so rapidly that it is quite possible that we don't really need to be free. So, for example, most of the inventions most of the discoveries are increasingly driven by computer power and artificial intelligence, why should we allow a professor at Beijing University, for example, exchanging his views with professors in other jurisdictions? Well, the answer, probably we don't need to. Similarly, we show in the book an example of Nikolai Bukharin. He was the founder of Gosplan in the Soviet Union in 1920s, before, of course, he was shot by Stalin in 1937. But he was the one who started the state planning system. It was a disaster. Various people tried to imitate various state planning system, from Allende, Chile in 1970s to Mao Zedong in 50s and 60s and 70s. All of them ended up to be a disaster. And so one of the interesting questions to me is Adam Smith's Invisible Hand really preferable to state planning? Or was Nikolai Bukharin simply a century of his time? He did not have the computational capacity to be able to plan. So when Jack Ma, founder of Alibaba, once said that with data, we might be able to discover Adam Smith's invisible hand, he could be right. And so China is truly believes in that, that the combination of state control and significantly enhanced computer power can allocate capital much better and much more coherently within the society than, you know, Adam Smith's invisible hand or a traditional liberal capitalist economies are able to.
Victor, what are the implications of that for the contest between America and China at the moment? Because underlying the trade war between them is America's frustration with China's success. It was meant to, after Tiananmen Square, China was meant to not succeed, go the way of Russia, but it did not. So, what is the implication of what you're saying now to about the contest now between America and China?
Well, the implications are that China could be on the verge of proving that liberal capitalism and capitalist economies no longer provide the best answer. In any event, liberal capitalist economies have been degrading and dying for at least the last 2 to 3 decades. And that's a result of both technology and financialization that was working through the system. Even today, central banks, as you know, completely dominate most of the financial markets and most of the economic flows, far more than they used to in 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. So liberal capitalism, it has already been sunsetting for several decades. What China is doing is saying there is an alternative answer. And most people saying that alternative answer are specific to China, but they are not. Many other countries are now propagating a very similar view, whether you think of Russia, whether you think of Turkey, many others are actually adopting a similar view. And what is that view? Well, that view basically says that the main axis of any nation is a state and a public sector. Yes, there will be some degree of freedom. Yes, there will be some competition. In fact, Chinese companies are killing each other almost every for a penny. But there is only one party that decides who is going to win and who is going to lose. And that party is the government, the state. And so unlike liberal capitalism, whereby the private sector is dominant and public sector basically provides a framework around which we operate, we live, we work. In China, state sector is totally dominant. And so usually that degree of dominance, as you correctly said, becomes a drag. It becomes a drag on innovation. It becomes a drag on vitality. It becomes a drag on competition, growth, and wealth. What China has been proving for the last several decades that it doesn't have to be, that actually one can have it both ways. One can have a very strong state, very strong state and public sector, and at the same time, one will not suffer from shortage or a disappearance of ideas, stagnation of ideas, stagnation of income, stagnation of wealth. And that is a competition between the United States and China. The competition is not so much just geopolitics, because China might want to grab certain territories. Competition is much, much deeper. Is what is the essence of our societies? Go back to my question, do we need to be free in order to be productive, in order to be innovative, wealthy, or even happy? China might prove that we don't need to have any of those ingredients. And what helps China, of course, is technology. Remember, the progression of artificial intelligence now primarily relies on availability of data. Most of the intellectual breakthroughs for the modern age have already been made. So from now on, a lot of it is to do with utilizing what we have already discovered over the last two or three decades. And China is the Saudi Arabia of data, because China doesn't have the same privacy, the same restrictions on transfer of accumulation of data as Western countries. So the ability to progress sort of the cutting edge of artificial intelligence and technology is much better in China than it is in other countries. If I may just say one more thing, the key, of course, is that have we discovered everything we need to discover for a while? If the answer is no, then China is still very much dependent on intellectual foundations of the West. If the answer is that we've pretty much discovered all we require, at least for a while, then it's the age of application, the age of development, rather than discoveries. And if that's the case, China has an edge, at least for the next several decades.
I want to ask you about modern monetary theory. You've written a fair bit about that in your notes for Macquarie, but you didn't focus on it very much in the book, only a little bit. So how does modern monetary theory fit in with your views about Western society and the future of liberal democracies?
Yeah, what we basically described in the book is that in 1980s, and one can debate the beginning of this period, but to me the most obvious beginning is 1971 with the end of the Bretton Woods. Paul Walker at the Federal Reserve in late 70s, early 80s. And even more importantly, I guess, Greenspan put option after Black Monday in 1987. From that point onwards, we as I decided to financialize. So in other words, as we discussed in the book, if you go back through 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, most of the time economists required no more than $1, $1.50 of debt for every dollar of GDP. After that, it mushroomed dramatically. And today, depending where you are, it could be $3 to $5 of debt for every incremental dollar of GDP that you're generating. So the question that we raised in the book, why have we as a society decided in 1980s to financialize? Why have we decided that transferring wealth and consumption from the future to the present is so important? Now, the answer to me is a slowing productivity growth rates. Most Western societies started to experience slow productivity growth rate in 70s and into 80s. Some of the emerging market and developing markets started to feel the same over the last 10 or 15 years. Now, we can debate why productivity has been slowing, but to me, the reason for that is that we exhausted the benefit of industrial revolutions, but we have not yet found a way of utilizing properly the benefits of information age. And those periods of hiatus, when productivity is low and stagnating, is very common. This is what happened at the earlier stages of the first industrial revolution. This is what happened in the earlier stages of the second industrial revolution. And sometimes those periods of slow productivity growth rates could last for decades. Usually it lasts at least one or two generations. And so to my mind, in 1980s, we had a choice, either to accept lower pay scale, lower wealth than what we think we deserve, and settle for lower growth rates, or we're going to find a way of becoming wealthier in other ways, by other means. And what we have decided as a society is that assets, leverage, is the way we're going to go forward. The way I described it in the book, that we essentially, prior to 1980s, most people derived money from wages. Houses were places you hide from the rain and cook your meals. They were not investable asset classes. But after 1980s, most people realized that relying on wages and household chattels like cars and refrigerators was a recipe for disaster, oblivion, poverty, irrelevancy, and all the bad stuff. And the only way we can get ahead in this world is through assets and leveraging. And so over the last 3 to 4 decades, we just moved on and we leveraged. That's why today we had 3-4 times more debt than the underlying GDP. Financialization is even higher. It's at least 5-10 times the underlying GDP. And as we continue to leverage, marginal utility of money declined. That in turn started creating disinflation, not inflation. That in turn started to compress growth rates. And so after global financial crisis, and certainly over the last 5 years, the view has become that that monetary policy are becoming too toxic. They're creating too many problems, whether it's disinflation, whether it's slowing growth rates, whether it's income and wealth inequalities. And so we need to find another way of growing. What is that other way of growing? Well, either productivity has to mushroom, and the chances are it will not happen for decades, because as I said, we're still going through the information age. Or alternatively, we need to switch public sector tools. So if you need to switch public sector tools, what do you want to have? Well, the answer is fiscal policies. Now, if it is fiscal policies, in other words, public sector becoming even more aggressive, controlling cycles, both business cycle and capital market cycles. But so it's not just spending. The question is, where do you spend the money and how do you pay for it? And what modern monetary theory basically tells you is that you don't need to bother so much with debt. You can connect central bank directly to fiscal spending, and you can then balance the economies through fiscal and taxation policies. So to me, we are now on the second part of the bridge to the new world. The first part of the bridge was primarily monetary. And that's what we lived with for the last 3 to 4 decades. The second part of the bridge will be primarily fiscal and then MMT. What lies beyond that bridge is anybody's guess. And what we suggested in the book, that what might lie beyond the bridge is enlightened version of communism rather than classical capitalism. And so the question we ask, on the other side of the black hole in a couple of decades from now, is it going to be capitalism or communism, feudalism or despotism? And it's a good, to me, that's the most important question. And then you step back and you say, okay, what policies can allow me to transit through the second part of the bridge that we are on and still keep as much of our freedom and as much of our liberties as we possibly can?
I assume that the pandemic that we're living through at the moment sharpens those views that you have about the role of fiscal policy and MMT that act as the bridge. Is that right?
Yes, it does. Again, the way I describe it in the book, every time there is a dislocation in some form, and you can look at dislocations going back to 1830s and 1840s and the 1870s and 80s, 1930s, 1960s, 70s, you can go to 1987, to 1997, to 2001, to 2005, 2008, 2020. Every time you have those sorts of dislocations, and they could be man-made, they could be financially made, they could be technology made, they could be nature made. It doesn't really matter that much what is the underlying source. But whenever you have this dislocation, societies need to make a choice. That's very similar to what we describe in the 15th century in the book, when the Chinese, the Ottomans, and the Russians had a choice to make. And they've decided that exchange of views, private property, civil rights, political participation, educational opportunities were against the nature of their society. And they've decided largely to abolish all of that. Well, the net result over 5 centuries, all 3 empires have collapsed. And England had industrial revolution. So every time we come to those junctions or turning points, we have to make a choice. And the choice that we've been making over the last 4 or 5 decades is to embrace a greater role of the government. And those choices become even more pronounced as we go forward, primarily because millennial and Z generations are now starting to constitute a larger and larger proportion of the voting population. In most Western democracies, it's now at least 1/3 of the electorate. And over the next 5-10 years, it's going to be a majority. Why is it important? Well, unlike baby boomers and X generations like us, the millennial and Z generations had a very different experience. They have seen 9/11, they have seen wars, they have seen declining premium for college education, they have seen disrupted work scene, they have seen a lot of quite nasty things. And the way they were brought up and the way technology impacted them, they tend to be much more sharing. They tend to be much more community-based than, say, baby boomer generation was. They also tend to ask for help. They, instead of eliminating the government, they want to co-opt the government to make this transition easier. And so to me, every one of those turning points, whether it's a coronavirus, whether it's a global financial crisis, whether it's .com, whether it's a Black Monday of 1987, we had a choice to make. And every time the choice actually tilted towards greater state involvement, if somebody were to ask anyone on the street, would you like to... There is a change we need to do. And would you like, as a part of that change, is to recognize that the house you're living in is not really worth what you pay for it? Would you like to recognize that years, possibly decades, of GDP growth rates were excessive? And therefore, the standard of living that you think you have, you don't really have. Would you like to recognize that we have accesses that we built into the system, and those accesses needs to be purged? The answer from people always is say, no, we don't like that. We want you to fix the problem rather than telling me that my house is not worth what I paid for it. And so to me, every time we ask for a fix, and as we continue to ask for a fix, state role by definition has to be wider, whether it's controlling the capital markets, whether it's backstopping asset classes, whether it's determining both quantity and prices of financial instruments, or whether it's a fiscal spending and reliance on fiscal cycles. Now, what coronavirus does, just like 87 gave birth to us, or Black Monday, if you remember Black Monday. Black Monday gave birth to really very aggressive monetary policy. That was turbocharged even more after global financial crisis in 08. What coronavirus is doing is turbocharging fiscal policy, as you correctly said, much more. Now, we could have made as a society a different choice, but that choice is not acceptable. So the bottom line becomes, if private sector is not able to grow at a pace that society demands and at a pace that financial markets demand, is it a responsibility of public sector to do so? And increasingly, the answer from almost everybody is yes. And the second question is to ask, do you think public sector is always inefficient, is always inefficient in allocating capital? Or do you think there is not much difference in most cases between public and private sector? The answer for most people increasingly now, there is no difference. And if that is the case, then that even further strengthens fiscal position and it further strengthens the requirements from people that the government becomes more proactive.
Do you say, therefore, that coronavirus leads inevitably to modern monetary theory?
Well, there is no such thing in life, in my view, as inevitability. We always have choices, and we can make different choices as God wrote. So, for example, one of the book describes is that in a world of declining return on humans, in other words, people become weaker and weaker contributor to productivity, and that trend is irreversible. In a world of declining return on humans, how can we make people happy? How can we make people comfortable? How can we make sure that they're leading a decent life? And the answer, and the only answer, is really basic income guarantees, so minimum income guarantees. And so one of the policy tools we have, and we're currently trying it on a global basis, is a widespread introduction of basic or minimum income guarantees. But there are other policies you can look at. There could be competition policies that could be quite different, regulatory policy, skilling and education policies. One of the things we highlight is that the least developed countries in the world in the next two decades will create well over a billion young people who will be looking for jobs. Just like Franks and Saxons were invading Roman Empire in the 3rd and 5th century, and Roman galleys could never keep them away from Danube and Rhine. Just like, as we discussed in the book, the Russians and Greeks couldn't keep away the Mongols and Turks in the 12th, 14th century. This sort of a demographic bulge cannot be held back. And so it almost inevitably lead to uncontrolled immigration. And so how can you solve that? Well, a very enlightened, but also incredibly intrusive Marshall-style plan for the least developed countries is one of the policy alternatives we have. The same applies on monetary to fiscal and monetary to MMT. So we have a variety of options that we have. The question that I kept on returning in the book to is to say, are we ready for what today are perceived to be extreme answers? Or do we need a much larger global dislocation for everybody to coalesce? Because people, generally speaking, and I don't mean to be insulting, but generally speaking, are quite lazy and are quite willing to let it go and don't prefer the preferred action not to do anything. That's your human resistance. That's why China and Russia and the Ottomans didn't do anything as they were collapsing over centuries. So the most obvious answer not to do anything. To make people and societies move, you need a dislocation. That's the only way it works. And so do we need a much larger dislocation in the next couple of decades in order to people to start coalescing much more aggressively around policies that made sense for years now, and certainly will make more sense going forward. So if you think of MMT, MMT is only one of the pattern of tools that can be used in order to ease our transition into a society, which inevitably evolving in the next several decades, where people, as I said, are no longer the key productivity drivers. And the way technological revolutions work, they start in a relatively low waterfront, and that waterfront tends to have a very high productivity rates. So in the first industrial revolution, that would have been steam, cotton, railway. In the second industrial revolution, that would have been chemical, pharmaceutical industry, that would have been cars. Today, it's IT, biotechnology, technology, artificial intelligence. Now, those areas tend to have a very high level of productivity. But what they do, they kill the rest of the economy one cut at a time, over a long time. And that's why aggregate productivity actually goes down. So we're going to go through this process of gradually realizing that how we use capital is different. What capital we use is different. How we use labor is different. A classic example, if inflation takes off, for example, and interest rates do go up, people tend to believe you need to buy short-dated paper because a long-dated paper, like technology companies, for example, are assuming growth over extended period. So if you discount it at a higher rate, clearly those companies are worth less. But my question is, do you think today do you think they will keep value better than Amazon or Microsoft? So in other words, that's your tangible versus intangible capital. So do you think intangible capital actually will provide a better hedge than a conventional tangible capital like roads or factories or machinery or whatever? And the answer in the new world, intangible capital is what counts. So to me, we will have to come to a decision that not only labor is used in a different way, role of labor is changing, but also role of capital changes. What capital earns return and how the capital is deployed becomes important. So all the governments who are saying we need more infrastructure investment in order to improve productivity, that's looking backwards. That's looking to 19th, 20th century. Is our productivity driven by roads now, or is it driven by something else?
You conclude that it's highly likely that Karl Marx's idea of communism, that is not the perverse socialist perversions that have dominated politics in the 20th century, but the actual idea of communism will be our common future. And you think that in the long term that's fine, but over the next several decades, you say, it's likely to be bleak and testing with a rollback of freedoms and a stifling of concentration of power. So you're saying that it's going to get worse before it gets better, is that right?
Yes. Yes, it is. And primarily because we are refusing to accept the inevitable or to be proactive. As I said, a lot of policy tools are there. They have existed for a long period of time, but they're not regarded as either suitable or acceptable. Karl Marx was arguably one of the first people ever to contemplate a society that has such a high level of productivity that labor force, work, many other things are become redundant. And therefore, what we do, we move people from a compulsion to work, which is what basically industrial societies have done, into from everyone according to his ability to everyone according to his needs. So in other words, there is no compulsion, is what you want to do. If you want to be a poet, you write poems. If you want to be an artist, you paint. If you want to be a scientist, you be scientist. It doesn't mean that you need to become a fund manager just because that's the only way you can think you can make money, even though you don't necessarily enjoy doing it. Now, and it wasn't just Karl Marx. I mean, John Maynard Keynes in 1930, in his paper, which was criticized quite extensively since then, but in a paper on economic opportunities for our grandchildren, he was arguing that within the next few generations, again, we will reach the level of productivity that people will no longer need to work. And the only question, of course, in that world, how do people get satisfaction? If it's not money, if it's not power, if it's not wealth, what will make you satisfied? Is it going to be sports? Is it going to be a religion? Is it going to be non-monetary reward? How do you actually make people feel satisfied? And the same ideas, of course, were propagated in 1980s and 1990s by the likes of Paul Romer or Ray Kurzweil or many others. So Karl Marx was the first one, I guess, or at least from economics perspective, who was thinking about those ideas back in the 1850s. But as I said, there is a long line of economists and political scientists dating through centuries who entertain a very similar idea. So the question is, what is communism? Communism become a very loaded word. Socialism become an incredibly loaded word, and most people are trying to steer away from that, and that's understandable. And when people say communism failed, I basically say we never tried it. So how could it fail? Because it's never been tried. And it's really, as you just said a second ago, it's really perversions of those ideas that people practice through the 20th century that colors our view. The essence of communism, or we can call it Nirvana, or we can call it John Maynard Keynes, you know, economic possibilities for our grandchildren, is that at some stage, a couple of decades from now, the productivity will suddenly be released. It's only will be released when we stop warehousing people in what one of the economists described as bullshit occupation. Because basically what we're doing now, we're warehousing people in bullshit occupation pending their disposal in some form that society ultimately finds acceptable. So productivity will mushroom. When the productivity does mushroom, it's going to be a different society. But between now and that eventual outcome, it could be a ravine of massive uncertainties, massive turbulence, geopolitical, political. Because remember, social, because remember, different countries, different individuals, different social groups are all will all be moving at a different speed in a different direction. And whenever that happens, that's where you have a social problem, that's where you have political problem, that's where you have geopolitical problems. And as people get disoriented, that is where they start looking for populists, that's where they start looking for demagogues. That's where you start getting unusual electoral outcomes, as we have been doing or having for the last decade, at least. And those populists tend to aggravate those problems rather than trying to solve those problems. I refer in my book to a previous well-known book by Norman Angell when he wrote it in 1910, saying that a war is not possible in such a tightly, globally integrated economy, and particularly given that the weapons of mass destruction started to proliferate. Now, you have to remember that in 1913, prior to the Great War, society was the most globalized it ever has been. And 1913 style of trade globalization and capital flow was not replicated again until 1990s. And so his argument was, we're so integrated, we're so globalized, and weapons of mass destruction are so prevalent that it's just inconceivable that we're going to have a war. 4 years after he wrote this book, Great War started. And so to argue that you can't have those outcomes in a modern society is very similar to repeating sort of the theme of the book of 1910. And so as people move in different directions, national groups move in different directions, states move in different directions and at a different speed, you will get more and more tensions. And the populists, I think, will aggravate those tensions rather than making them easier. So it's going to be a tough world. Gradually, also, professions will be atrophying. If you're a journalist, if you're an analyst, if you're a fund manager, if you're paralegal, if you're a musician, entertainer, you pretty much already discovered what information age will do to you. Very similar to, you know, Luddites in the early 1800s. You're already realizing what's happening. It's not going to be too long before truck drivers and taxi drivers and construction workers will feel pretty much the same way. And then it will spread wider. PhD students, graduates in science, graduates in computer technology will feel the same way. It's not so much that you are worth less and less, is it just becoming less and less relevant or more and more irrelevant?
Just finally, Victor, before I let you go, which is we've had a long talk, but I just wanted to try to finish on a slightly more positive note. You spend a lot of time in the book talking, investigating the Black Death, and you propose that the Black Death led to the Renaissance. Are there parallels between the Black Death and the coronavirus, and might that lead to some other new kind of Renaissance? Is there a parallel?
Yes, there is. I would hope that coronavirus is nothing like the Black Death, and certainly human suffering and terrible things that occurred in the 14th and their revisitations in the 15th centuries will not happen again. So I hope it's not going to be as bad, but the parallels are there. There is no question that information age is a renaissance. It's an extension and progression of a renaissance of 15th, 16th, 17th century, scientific revolution of 18th century. And in fact, it's accelerating it substantially faster. So it is a renaissance. And I think both our lives, and what we do and how we do it will be changed for better, for much, much better. In fact, I would argue that our grandchildren probably will shudder at a thought that their grandparents needed to go to work. I think they will shudder at the thought how we treated each other. So I think it's going to be a different world that is emerging. But as I said, it's several decades, if not longer, away. Human nature also can be both generous and vindictive. It can be creator of good, equally it can be creator of evil. And technology and financialization, what we call Fujiwara effect, that pushes us towards that black hole, it doesn't have a preference for good or bad. It has no moral standing one way or the other. It just moves whenever it feels like moving. And it's really our responsibility to make sure that it actually flows into the right channel. Because as you correctly said, it is a renaissance. And coronavirus, amongst other things, is what accelerating us towards that point. And in its ultimate, I think it could end up to be a better, more sustainable society. One of the things we haven't discussed in the book at all, because there were just too many issues to discuss, is environment and the question of environment and biological footprint. But I think there are policies you can start putting in place, and I think we will be, it's just a matter of timing, to make it a more sustainable society and an economy, not just from an environmental point of view, but other aspects as well. Definitely, renaissance. The question is, How many generations do we need to waste in between? Because people who suffer most are those who are going through this. It's like a lot of people suggest Luddites were wrong in smashing looms in earlier 1800s England. They were not wrong. They knew exactly what's happening. Looms are reducing their marginal pricing power. They're reducing their marginal utility. They're converting them into the slaves of a factory system. They knew exactly what they were doing. And they were not wrong, because they saw it took about 50 years for standard of living to finally start improving. I think one of the things I've mentioned in the note, if you suddenly get transported into early 1800s, and you encounter a bunch of Luddites and you say, please don't do this. It's going to be okay. Don't smash the looms. In 40 or 50 years' time, it's going to be okay. I wonder whether they will think you're joking. that 40, 50. And similarly, if you think of revolutionary barricades of 1848, of 1870, again, those people were not wrong. They knew that this would lead to inequalities, this will increase exploitation, all sorts of things are going to happen. Now, ultimately, everybody says it was okay. You know, the proletariat, the craftsmen were converted into proletariat, the aristocracy, which used to rule the roost, become either bourgeoisie or capitalist, or they ascended into the government or ascended into academia or descended into proletariat. The farmers were okay. They were still much better off than the tenant farmers of the, you know, in France in 18th century. So ultimately, it was all okay. It is. But when we say it's all okay, we don't feel the pain of people who actually had to go through this. And it so happened the next several decades will be the period that we would need to go through this. And that impacts everything, what you do, how you feel, what you study, how you interact. It also depends how you invest. What asset classes would you prefer? The question is, what type of investment will exist on that second part of the bridge until you get into the new age?
I have to leave it there, Victor. Maybe we'll pick it up from that point at a future time. So I've really appreciated talking to you. Thanks very much.
Okay, Alan. Cheers.
That was Victor Schwetz, Macquarie Research's man in Hong Kong and the author of The Great Rupture, Do We Need to Be Free?